are listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast, brought to you by the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording of a webinar called The Queen's Speech and Protecting Rights, which was held on the 25th of May 2022. The webinar was chaired by Vary Snowden, Director of the Human Rights Consortium Scotland, and the speakers were Catherine Barnard, the Deputy Director of UK in a Changing Europe, Charlie Felton, Policy and Campaigns Officer at Liberty, Kevin Hanratty, the Director of the Human Rights Consortium in Northern Ireland, Charles Whitmore, a Research Associate at Cardiff University School of Law and Politics, and Rosalind Stevens, the Project Manager of the Civil Society Alliance.
Good afternoon, everybody. If I haven't met you before, my name is Vary Snowden. I'm Director of the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. And can I first welcome you all to this lunchtime webinar on the Queen's Speech and Protecting Rights. As you might know, the Queen's Speech included 38 bills plus other commitments, and many of them threw up interesting questions really about what the UK government sees as the biggest problems of the moment, whether that is spies or spurious human rights cases, online harm, protesters attaching themselves to railings, cancel culture, al fresco dining. But what is clear is that the agenda, first of all, of the UK Parliament this year is huge, and also that it's one that as civil society organisations, we need to be really engaged with, because some of those bills could have potentially huge impacts on the rights of those that we work with and for. So that is what we're looking at today. We're looking at some of those, what's in there that we should be keeping an eye on. Now, I am absolutely delighted to welcome our panel of speakers. I'm going to introduce them all just now so that we can move seamlessly from one to the other. So can I welcome Catherine Barnard from UCL, and who is a Deputy Director of UK in a Changing Europe. Charlie Wilton, who is a Policy and Campaigning Officer from Liberty. Kevin Hanratty, who is Director of the Human Rights Consortium in Northern Ireland, and Charles Whitmore from WCVA and the Wales Governance Centre. Each speaker is going to address this question: what are key parts of the Queen's Speech that will affect rights and that civil society should be keeping an eye on? So that is the key question that will be addressed in this quick 45 minutes. So without further ado, I welcome Catherine Barnard to begin this webinar with her reflections. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you very much indeed for this kind invitation. It's a great privilege to be here. I'm going to talk about two issues, Brexit Freedoms Bill and the Bill of Rights, which of course both have a direct impact on citizens' rights going forward. It's going to be a whistle-stop tour, so hang on to your hats. Start with the Brexit Freedoms Bill. Well, I don't need to explain to this audience the context, but in particular, this is about retained EU law. And retained EU law is all of that EU law that was translated into the into UK law by the EU Withdrawal Act 2018. Now, this government has been very opposed to that technique, which was adopted by Theresa May, and they want to do three things. One, to make it much easier to amend or repeal retained EU law. And I should say, I've seen some stuff, which is not in the Queen's Speech, which suggests that they might stick a sunset clause on the entire corpus of retained EU law. In other words, that by a certain date, all retained EU law will stop unless a department decides to opt back into it. Secondly, to remove the supremacy of retained EU law. I'll explain that in a moment. And thirdly, clarify the status of retained EU law, reflecting the fact that much of it's gone through without full democratic scrutiny in the United Kingdom. This last point is nonsense, in fact, because, of course, it went through democratic scrutiny at EU level and went through a democratic process there. And, of course, UK committees did have a look at it, but this is the mantra. So the first point about creating new powers to amend or repeal the large amounts of retained EU law, well, in fact, They already have significant powers to do just that. Now, it is complicated, and because my time is short, I won't go through all the nuts and bolts of it. But as this diagram shows, it is quite possible already from the 2018 Act to amend or repeal retained EU law. And it's also worth bearing in mind that lots of legislation which has been adopted recently has what's called a Henry VIII clause in it. And to remind you, Henry VIII clause gives ministers the power by secondary legislation to reverse both secondary and primary legislation. And large numbers of Henry VIII clauses pepper all recent legislation, even legislation that doesn't appear to have anything whatsoever to do with EU law. So it is already very easy for the government to get rid of, to modify, retained EU law. And of course, you can do it under the various provisions in Section 7 of EWA, that's the 2018 Act. Remember, too, it's also very easy for the government to take control of the legislative agenda. Standing Order 14 allows that. So why is all this talk about making it much easier? Well, the simple reason is that they don't like having all of this retained EU law on the statute book. They want to ensure that it is British law, going back to the point I made before, that it hasn't gone through, in their view, democratic scrutiny. The real concern here is, as a result, as with any Henry VIII clause, is how it's being delivered. Henry VIII clauses often allow negative resolution. In other words, very easy to lay a statutory instrument to turn off retained EU law. And if it's a negative procedure, it's incredibly easy. No statutory instrument has been overturned, which has been adopted by the negative procedure since 1978. So there is a total lack of scrutiny of any legislation that is being turned off by the negative procedure. Affirmative is slightly slower, but nevertheless, it's still pretty easy to turn off retained EU law. For those of you who are lawyers, the real concern is that the government will give itself the equivalent of a reverse Section 2-2 power, 2-2 from the European Communities Act. For those of you who aren't lawyers, the bottom line is it will be very easy to turn off retained EU law, and indeed it may indeed all be subject to a sunset clause. The other point for you to be aware of is supremacy. Now, supremacy of EU law is that if there is a conflict between pre-Brexit EU law and pre-Brexit UK law, then the pre-Brexit EU law trumps the pre-Brexit UK law. Now, I can imagine a lot of you thinking, oh God, my brain hurts, this is horrible. But to give you a concrete example, Article 157 of the TFEU on equal pay for men and women, that's pre-Brexit EU law, and it trumps any conflicting provision of the Equality Act 2010. Now, the UK government wants to turn off this notion of supremacy. If I'm honest, I was somewhat surprised to see supremacy even in the 2018 Act, but the idea behind the 2018 Act was essentially to cut and paste the pre-Brexit position and make it the current position. Jacob Rees-Mogg is determined to turn this off. The problem is quite how he will do it. There are different ways that could be done. Some people suggest it could just result in a simple name change and you got rid of the word supremacy, because supremacy is such a vexed term. You could talk about primacy, or more realistically, conflicts. That if there's a conflict between two different norms, which one prevails? I suspect this is not radical enough for this government. Some people are saying you look at the date of the EU directive or the EU measure. In the case of Article 157, it would indeed be 1957, and it would only trump legislation before 1957. So, of course, it wouldn't trump the Equality Act 2010. But this is an area which is deeply uncertain. Just before I move on to say a word or two about the Bill of Rights, the other thing to look out for, which did not appear in the Queen's speech, is what's going to happen about the Northern Ireland Protocol. Now, as far as the Northern Ireland Protocol is concerned, you're all very well aware of what the government is saying about the protocol and that Liz Truss is determined to lay legislation. I'm told the legislation will be laid on the 6th of June. It's still not clear what the legislation will say, and also it's still not clear whether legislation will be wrapped up in this retained EU law Brexit Freedoms Bill, which is one suggestion. It's also not clear, as far as the Northern Ireland Protocol is concerned, whether it will be substantive provisions or whether it will only be powers to turn off, for example, Articles 5 to 10 and 12 of the Northern Ireland Protocol. As far as human rights is concerned, we know, and I don't need to tell this audience, just how important the Human Rights Act is. We also know the government has tried to do various reviews of the Human Rights Act to make it fit for purpose. We are now told in the Queen's speech that my government will ensure the constitution is defended. This does raise a question, defended from whom and where the attacks are coming from. Presumably it's the courts, because the second sentence says, my ministers will restore the balance of powers between the legislature and the courts. Now, again, this is a somewhat puzzling statement, because of course the courts have always known that if they make a decision that the legislature doesn't like, excuse me one moment, if they make a decision the legislature doesn't like, then the legislature can pass an act of parliament to overturn that court decision. So quite what these rather grand statements mean is a cause for concern. And then you've got, we're going to introduce this Bill of Rights, which will strengthen freedom of speech and strengthen our common law. But just remember, our common law gives significant power to the judges to make law, always subject to being overturned by the legislature. This is nuts and bolts of our system. Nevertheless, this is not what the Queen's speech is saying. Main elements of the bill. So here, establishing the primacy of UK case law. Ironic to use the word primacy, which sounds like a bit like supremacy anyway, which is being turned off about EU law, establishing the primacy of UK case law, clarifying there's no requirement to follow the Strasbourg case law. Well, that already puts us potentially in breach of our obligations under the European Convention. And that the UK courts cannot interpret rights in a more expansive manner. It's not at all clear to me what expansive means legally. Of course, we know what the political objectives are. Also, a check on making sure UK courts can no longer alter legislation contrary to its ordinary meaning. Well, of course, this very much depends on understanding that the courts have always had a role in interpreting UK legislation without proper democratic oversight. Well, again, this is very odd, because Parliament has always been free to intervene, guaranteeing that spurious cases, what is a spurious case? What might be a spurious case to you might not be a spurious case to me. Don't undermine public confidence and the responsibility to demonstrate a significant disadvantage before a human rights claim can be heard in court will be placed on the claimant. So if there are multiple people who are suffering some disadvantage, but not significant disadvantage, that won't be enough. Collective misery is not enough. It's got to be significant disadvantage to the claimant. So this is what's coming down the line. It seems to me that the facts justifying legislation in this field are rather thin. It certainly looks like Section 2 of the Human Rights Act is going to be amended, so which says the court must take into account decisions of Strasbourg to May. Deeply concerning, this talk about lack of democratic oversight of the courts. Does this mean that down the line, judges are going to have to be elected? Now, clearly, that's not what this bill's about, but it's something worth looking at. For those who are interested, there's a really good blog by Joshua Rosenberg on this, and he concludes, this bill may tinker with the Human Rights Act, but it's not, in any sense of the term, a Bill of Rights. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you as well to Catherine for that opening session. My name is Charlie. I work for Liberty, and you know, the title, as you've heard of this webinar, is "What are the key parts of the Queen's speech that will affect rights that civil society should keep an eye on?" That's a very difficult question because the answer is so much of it. Of the 38 bills, I would say that we're probably concerned about maybe half of them. I don't have anywhere near enough time to talk about half of the bills in the speech, so I'll just go through a few quite quickly. The Public Order Bill, first of all, if you haven't heard about this, this is essentially the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act Part 2. More specifically, this bill is a collection of amendments that were put forward to that bill when it was in the Lords just a few months ago. The Lords roundly dismissed all of them, would not accept any of these, and they were quite correct in doing so. But the government, as is their right, has brought them back in a separate bill. What is in them? There are new offences relating to locking on, to protests that might disrupt transport or infrastructure. There are new stop and search powers, protest-specific stop and search powers, whether with suspicion or not. And really most concerning for us is a new form of civil order, the Serious Disruption Prevention Order, or SDPO, which would ban individuals from participating in protests. It would require them to be subject to 24/7 GPS monitoring and essentially bar their participation in public life. Why should you be concerned about this? Well, I mean, there are two really big reasons, I would say. One of them is very, very obvious, which is that this is a major infringement on the rights to protest. We at Liberty regard this as a staggering escalation of the government's clampdown on dissent, which we have seen in so many forms over the past couple of years. And really what is also very concerning is that the Home Office is entirely aware of what this bill does. It is aware that the new orders will take away a person's right to protest. They are aware that this will be subject to legal challenge, that they would be ineffective. And they're aware of this because they have been told it specifically by Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services. They've been told all this. This advice has been published. So it will be potentially unlawful and entirely ineffective, and yet they are doing it anyway. We know that when people like us, and probably like a lot of the organisations on this call, tell the Home Office that something they're doing will be bad and potentially unlawful, they're not going to care. But they are getting this advice, the same advice from their inspectorates, from their lawyers and everybody else, and they're ignoring it because it's very useful to take action against protests. And it's very useful to take action against migrants, for example, with the Nationality and Borders Bill, with the Rwanda Plan, and so on. So I think civil society needs to be very aware that this is what this Home Office is. Moving on to the Bill of Rights, which of course has been spoken about already. This is another case of a government department carrying on with something which they've been told will not work. The update to the Act in the Conservative Manifesto turned into an overhaul when Dominic Raab took over, and then it seems has turned into a repeal now in favour of a Bill of Rights. There was a 580-page independent report which explained how they could update the Act. This was ignored and replaced with a Dominic Raab wish list. So, you know, we've already seen some of what is supposed to be in the Bill of Rights. Essentially, what it will do is that it will make it harder to bring cases, harder to get justice, the permission stage and damages contingent on your conduct. Gone will be positive obligations. There'll be no duty on the government to safeguard your rights. There'll be divergence between Strasbourg and Strasbourg jurisprudence and ours, and even the meanings of rights in the ECHR and in this new Bill of Rights. There are provisions on deportations and asylum that will certainly risk breaching international law, to put it lightly. The government will have a freer hand with courts losing powers to interpret legislation and provide proper oversight. More than anything, it will create classes of people who are deserving of rights and those who are not. Again, why should you be concerned? This should probably be quite obvious why you should be concerned about these things. It's more power for the government, it's fewer rights for us. It'll be harder to get justice in issues big and small, and it will run roughshod over devolved administrations, potentially causing concerns about peace and stability in Northern Ireland. Whatever you work on, and whatever you're concerned about, this will affect you. We're even beginning to see this now. It is manifesting through other bills in the Queen's speech. To take a couple of examples, the National Security Bill has provision in it which mirrors the damages proposals, reducing, including to nil, damages in cases where somebody has a connection to terrorism. This is, we're seeing a proposal from the Bill of Rights already manifesting in legislation. Likewise, in the Northern Ireland Troubles Bill, which I'm sure is going to be spoken about later, reading the bill, the extent to which it appears to breach Article 2 duties really only makes sense when you read it considering it existing in a post-Bill of Rights world, in a world where the Bill of Rights has been brought in, where positive obligations are discarded, and where it doesn't really matter what Strasbourg thinks about things. That bill only really makes sense when you think about it in that context. I don't have very much time left, but I'm going to talk a little bit about data, about tech and privacy. The Data Reform Bill announced in the Queen's speech stands to amend and overhaul the GDPR. Things like that's not very exciting on the surface, but it's concerning. It speaks about providing more space for innovation in tech, and what this means is removing protections against automated decision making and artificial intelligence. We've already seen in a policing context how damaging automated decision making can be, how much it can lead to enhanced discrimination against people and really entrenching prejudice. And removing protections and constraints to it is a very concerning prospect. It will also restrict subject access requests. We've seen over the last few years how the government has hated freedom of information requests. They're a very important mechanism that we need for accountability, but also the subject access requests are just important in practical manners as well. If you are, if you need to prove that you are a victim of modern slavery and trafficking, for example, for an immigration claim, a subject access request is often a very vital component in that. And it would be much harder to bring one about under this bill. Also, the Online Safety Bill, people will be aware of this. This is carried over from the last session. It's already in its committee stage. There are various concerns, but one I would mention is that there's real concern about encryption and about online anonymity. They justify these things by saying that it's about protecting children from sexual abuse and exploitation, which, who could be opposed to that? But losing encryption and anonymity will harm us all, and privacy once lost is lost forever. This, of course, relates back to the Bill of Rights in itself, which has a really quite concerning attack on privacy, not only from the freedom of expression provisions, which they say will improve freedom of expression, but really all they will do is they will harm privacy rights, but to a greater extent than they will freedom of expression rights, but also in the full frontal attack on Article 8 and our right to home and family life. That was a very, very, very quick run through some of these things. They're very concerning. And I would just say, if you're interested in working on the Bill of Rights, do get in touch with Liberty, because this is going to be our main thing over the next however long it takes. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie. I think it's my turn to give a few reflections on what was in the Queen's speech last week. My name is Kevin Hanratty. I'm the director of the Human Rights Consortium. I agree with everything that's been said already by the two previous speakers, and cumulatively for Northern Ireland, what was reflected and what was conveyed last week in the Queen's speech just holds a multitude of really concerning proposals and draft legislative concepts. I suppose first and foremost, the Human Rights Act reform, the proposal for a Bill of Rights. Our view fundamentally on that since December, and the idea was announced that there would be a Bill of Rights for the UK, is that this is not, as Catherine has pointed out, it's not a Bill of Rights. It's contrary to the concept of what a Bill of Rights should contain. Bill of Rights largely internationally reflect progressive standards, reflect international development of human rights, reflect the wishes of a society in terms of how it wants to shape and be governed in a rights framework. This Bill of Rights, in terms of the draft proposals, would do none of those things. It doesn't secure the existing standards in terms of how we access convention rights. If anything, it actually goes backwards and destroys the way in which we currently access convention rights. I'll not repeat what others have said about, you know, the wider UK reflection, but what I would like to say is focus on the Northern Ireland dimensions of this. Like the three sort of all devolved areas of the UK, there was provisions in their devolved legislation that the Assembly would be bound to act compatibly with the Convention rights when it was given domestic and Human Rights Act. But beyond that, access to the Convention rights took on a sort of different dynamic and an added dynamic in Northern Ireland, that it was part of the wider confidence building measures of the peace process. And there was a lot of reassurance drawn both from those members of the public who voted for the Good Friday Agreement, but also the political parties who agreed to participate in the institutions and structures set up under the agreement, that the convention rights would be upheld in the terms of the decision-making processes that flowed from those departments, public bodies, public authorities. That has been the case and the understanding in terms of how the convention rights have been applied over the last 20 plus odd years in terms of the operation of the Stormont institutions. But these proposals really drive a sort of coach and horse through how the convention rights would be accessible, would be applicable, and would be utilised in Northern Ireland. As Catherine pointed out, the changes to the sort of Section 2 consideration of European Court of Human Rights, the jurisprudence from that, will fundamentally be altered and would be diluted. To the point where it really calls into question our compatibility with those convention rights in terms of how decisions might be taken. The positive obligations that will be eroded, as Charlie points out, will fundamentally interfere with historic cases here, particularly in terms of legacy discussions and investigations. As we well know, in terms of the jurisprudence coming from the Court of Human Rights, there were distinct standalone cases coming from Strasbourg in the 80s and 90s that set a clear criteria in terms of the obligations on investigating authorities when investigating violations of Article 2 and 3. Those obligations are potentially eroded. And cumulatively, that means that in terms of what people agreed to and what people signed up to in terms of the Good Friday Agreement, in terms of accessing those convention rights, it is and does represent a violation of the Good Friday Agreement. That argument is currently, however, falling on deaf ears. The UK government, who seem determined to read the Good Friday Agreement selectively and interpret different elements of either consent or human rights according to their own interpretation of what should be developed in the next legislative period. In terms of other bits, the Brexit Freedoms Bill creates huge concern for us in terms of ending the supremacy of EU law and potentially removing or changing or eroding retained law. That creates all sorts of concerns for the UK as a whole, but in terms of Northern Ireland, there's at some stage going to be read across with the Article 2.1 powers of the protocol, whereby elements of EU law that are specifically protected for Northern Ireland, either in directives in Annex 1 of the protocol, or protected via the incorporation of EU law via the Rights, Safeguards and Equality of Opportunity Section of the Good Friday Agreement, there will be overlap between that and other elements of retained EU law that could be jeopardised by these proposals. And the irony of saying that they want to, in this legislation, make it easier to remove existing legislation without using primary legislation, yet the rationale for wanting to remove it is that it didn't enjoy the full parliamentary scrutiny when it was first introduced is amazing. This would create huge problems for those Article 2.1 powers, and the Human Rights Commission and dedicated mechanisms already pointed that out, but it seems to have largely been ignored. The moves to change the protocol are deeply worrying. Yes, they're focused on the business elements of the protocol, but I think those speak to concerns we have about the stability of the protocol more broadly. There are specific human rights protections within the protocol, as I've said, in Article 2.1. But when this was signed in 2019, things like the oversight of the European Court of Human Rights European Court of Justice for Articles 5 to 10 that dealt with the customs union were largely uncontested. Now we've seen in the command paper last July that they've been thrown into the mix as being questionable and up for negotiation. Our concern is that once the dedicated mechanism powers under those Article 2.1 provisions, once there is the first court judgment potentially around how those powers prevent the UK government, for instance, maybe from taking or removing some of that retained EU law, what the government's response will be. Will it then place the Article 2.1 powers up as being the next objective in terms of things that should be negotiated away from the agreement? And that would be our wider concern. But there's also a concern that, you know, there are mechanisms for dealing with issues in terms of controversies around the operation of the protocol, but the UK government simply are not following those. They are not dealing with and utilising the mechanisms internal to the protocol, but are taking unilateral actions. And again, in terms of the rule of law, international agreements, the Good Friday Agreement being one, it really makes for quite a confusing picture, but also stability in Northern Ireland in terms of the being able to stand by those protocols and those provisions is really called into question. And then Charlie finally mentions the legacy proposals. There were existing agreements in the Stormont House Agreement for truth recovery processes and investigations that have really just been destroyed by the legislation that was introduced yesterday in the House of Commons. There are provisions, as we've said, in Article 2 and 3 of the Convention to carry out effective and proper investigations into legacy investigations. The proposals, as put forward in the legislation yesterday, really destroy that. This has been called into question by the Human Rights Commission here, by the UN Human Rights Council and the Council of Europe, yet the UK government have chosen to totally ignore those recommendations. So cumulatively, that's only four bits of the Queen's speech that are problematic, but I think it speaks to a deregulation agenda and a move away from rights protections that the UK government seemed bound to follow. There are two small bits of positive news in the Queen's speech, and one is the move to sort of force the health authorities here to introduce abortion services provision. Legislation was introduced in Westminster a couple of years ago to do that, but the health department here failed to act and commission the services. That has now been taken forward through Westminster legislation. And finally, Irish Language Act provision, that was agreed as part of the New Decade, New Approach back in January 2020. But again, parties failed to take it forward in domestic legislation at the Assembly, and the UK government has now stepped into the breach to provide that. So there's two small bits of good news coming out of the Queen's speech, but broadly the picture is quite negative and regressive. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks to the consortium and all the previous speakers. We're running out of time, so I'm going to cut what I had to say short. I'll try and not repeat anything that was said and just briefly highlight some points around devolution that emerge from the speech for me. So clearly the Brexit Freedoms Bill, as previously said, a very big concern. Anything around this fast-track mechanism to amend or repeal retained EU law is problematic from a scrutiny and transparency point of view. Unsurprisingly, there's very little information about interactions with devolution here, but I think there are some significant questions around how these proposals will interact with the common frameworks process. So these mechanisms for enhanced intergovernmental collaboration and cooperation in shared policy areas. It strikes me that any fast track mechanism to make changes in these areas could be problematic. And we're starting to see a disconnect and divergent views emerge here, with, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg, for instance, saying that these common frameworks do not limit anything the UK government can do and are just for telling the devolved governments what it is doing. I think there's a fundamental difference here with how these are viewed in practice and in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. There are a couple of very specific pieces of legislation that are highlighted as taking advantage of the benefits of Brexit, or removing barriers inherited from the EU, or that just generally require attention. So as Charlie said, the Public Order Bill, the UK Bill of Rights, I won't reiterate anything from those, agree with everything that's said. Some interesting, unclear devolved interactions in some areas, like the Procurement Bill, for instance, where the resulting landscape is looking quite challenging to unpack for some, where we've got central reforms, devolved reforms, interactions with new trade agreements, and a common framework as well. Other areas like the Conversion Therapy Bill caught my eye. Wales is trying to introduce its own measures here in response to what we feel is very much an inadequate proposal at the UK level. And it's unclear how these will interact. some substantive concerns with specific pieces of legislation as well. So Civil Society Alliance and members have highlighted the Genetic Technology and Precision Breeding Bill, for example, as not reflecting views received at consultation, but also creating the risk of divergence with what happens at the EU level and also what's happening within the UK where this is devolved. So coming to my final point now, and in keeping with the previous speakers, I'm very sorry that I have to raise yet another aspect of the Queen's speech that raises concerns for me that I think we need to keep a track on, but trade features quite heavily as well. There's a specific trade bill to implement the Australia and New Zealand trade agreements, which themselves raise some rural and agricultural concerns, but then by extension also for the well-being of rural communities with wider implications for health and culture, for example, where the economies of these communities might be threatened. However, the government also continues to highlight in the speech how its freedom to now negotiate new trade agreements is one of the main benefits of Brexit. It mentions accession to the CPTPP. We know there are negotiations happening with India, for instance, where we have significant human rights concerns. Yet this is also an area where we have some of the lowest transparency and weakest governance. So from the Wales perspective, for instance, trade is reserved, but implementation is a responsibility of the devolved governments. And there's a clear intersection here with devolved competence. Materially speaking, in areas like health, rural, environmental, and agricultural policy, but also more broadly speaking around consistency in areas where we have work, like our human rights agenda, for instance, where we're trying to be an international model. So if the UK government's trade agreements aren't green or human rights driven, that conflicts very much with the devolved work on global responsibility and human rights. Yet, in parallel, we have very weak transparency, scrutiny, and consultation mechanisms around trade in the UK at the UK level to help improve and shape this policy. So where there are consultations, these are geared very much towards businesses, for example. Just finally, I think this is very much a problem and a missed opportunity, really, because trade can be both a driver or hindrance to a huge variety of social justice areas, from human rights and equality to sustainable development. And depending on whether the policy is developed inclusively at an early stage, you might have an outcome, for instance, that can support or disadvantage women, for example. And I think increasingly, organizations are recognizing that we need to reframe trade as a vehicle to drive these wider human rights and sustainable development goals forward. But this isn't a connection that's being made by the UK government at the moment. So there are tensions between its very nebulous trade policy, if I can call it that, and the wider ambition it has to champion human rights that they've reiterated again in this Queen's speech. Of course, none of this will come as a surprise to anyone working on the UK Bill of Rights, but I think this is something we need to be pushing with our devolved governments in particular, because they are having intergovernmental conversations with the UK government about this and really get them to emphasize the inclusiveness and how we need to make the connection between trade and these other policy areas like human rights, for instance. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles, and thanks all our speakers. So if you didn't know it already, you know very clearly now that actually what is coming up is very concerning. Our rights are at risk, including what should be called the Bill of Watering Down Rights. We need to keep an eye on many things, including our quality protections, including that deregulation agenda, including measures that are against protest and including many measures that affect areas like privacy, including what's coming up in trade agreements. So there are big plans and they're very important, and we need to raise our voice about them as civil society. So to round off this whistle-stop tour of much detail that is quite flummoxing, the big message is actually there's loads to be concerned about, and let's get involved in the detail and influencing that. If you are concerned about the Bill of Watering Down Rights and you want to be part of that, then as Charlie has shared his contact, get in touch with Liberty at UK level. If you're in Northern Ireland, get in touch with the Human Rights Consortium there or the Human Rights Consortium in Scotland, and we'll be doing collective work on it because we are better and we've got a stronger voice when we work together. If you're involved in some of the other aspects, particularly that Brexit Freedoms Bill and the risk to equality protections that's within that, then you might want to get involved with Civil Society Alliance. I'm going to give Rosalind literally 2 minutes to tell us what is a Civil Society Alliance and why should people join it.
Yeah, okay, it'll be less than 2 minutes, I hope. So we're a new project that's been set up following in the footsteps of the Brexit Civil Society Alliance, And our aims are, well, I'll make them very concise. We want open and accountable lawmaking, a high standards UK, and most importantly, a strong civil society voice. I put in the chat there the details of our website. We are building our membership right now across the UK and running to catch up with all the bills that are all being thrown at us that will actually take up our time over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, I'm sure. So our power and our strength will come by the depth and the breadth of the membership across the UK, and we want to represent everybody across the UK. So if you haven't already joined us, please get in touch. If you go to our website, it will tell you how to do that. And I'm happy to have a chat with anybody at any time. And I'm just going off now, actually, to have our first members planning meeting. So any of you that are already members, I hope that you are going to join us. And just to stress again that although the Brexit benefits bill hasn't actually been published, I believe also that this is what's coming out on the 6th of June, and it's all going to be connected in terms of the Reul review. So we need to be very proactive in keeping an eye on that. And thank you very much to the previous speakers who have flagged up a lot of things for me to watch out for. Thank you, everybody. Look forward to meeting you all.
Thanks, Rosalind. Thank you for being so short and to the point. So do get involved. Let's get involved in the detail and influencing around it. And so can I say thank you to all our speakers, and I hope the rest of you have a good day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at @hrcscotland. Thank you.